Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two important new and revealing studies assessing the first year of the Trump administration. The first, Trump's national security and foreign policy failures, year one. And the second, what internet search data reveal about Donald Trump's first year in office. Daniel Ben-Aim, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate, joins us to discuss his report on the first year of Trump's abysmal foreign policy record, which has left America more isolated and less respected, and the extraordinary speech in the Senate today by Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who likened Trump to Joseph Stalin and other despots, warning, quote, "The president has it precisely backwards. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy." And in terms of Trump's lasting damage to our foreign policy, quote, "Mr. President, so powerful is the presidency that the damage done by the sustained attack on the truth will not be confined to the president's time in office." Then we will speak with Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution and the Founding Director of the Center for Technological Innovation. He's the author of Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust, and the author of a new report, What Internet Search Data Reveal About Donald Trump's First Year in Office, which finds that over the year, the public's interest in Trump has dropped dramatically, while interest in his impeachment has spiked. Then finally, we'll examine the arrest of an ex-CIA officer charged with spying on China, who was suspected of exposing the CIA's spy network in China, causing the murder or capture of around 20 undercover U.S. agents. June Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in Chinese government and foreign policy, who was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, joins us to discuss the pervasive nature of China's spying activity in the U.S. and the tensions between the CIA and FBI counterintelligence over their mole hunt inside the CIA. And joining us now, Daniel Ben-Aim, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, researching U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as the Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Ben-Aim.
Thank you for having me.
And the report that you come up with is quite damning, but not entirely surprising. I mean, when you think about the way that the world, and I imagine by extension world leaders, and I'm talking about longstanding allies like the UK, where Trump is not even able to come and visit, let alone attend a royal wedding. But the front page of the German equivalent of Time magazine, Der Spiegel, showing the famous evolution from ape to man, reversing it with ending up with Donald Trump as this sort of de-evolution of mankind, is pretty stinging. But I take it that the real issue here is that the damage done so far, and we're only talking about 1 year, is going to be lasting. And presumably it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to undo the damage.
You know, that's exactly right. We started this project as we approached a year because we realized that so many of us are so deeply wrapped up in the daily back and forth over each of these issues, each of these outrages, each of these gaffes, that we wanted to try to step back and kind of survey the landscape and ask what's really happened. Where are we after 1 year? And I think you're exactly right. It's already early enough that we know that some of the damage that President Trump has done will outlast him. And there, we know already that there's going to be a significant cleanup ahead in terms of restoring America's moral standing in the world and in terms of shaping up our institutions at home and in terms of trying to rebuild some kind of a consensus inside the country as to what our foreign policy should do, each of which Trump has in its own way kind of come in and shattered. So we stepped back and we started asking ourselves, well, what does this all mean? What does this all add up to? And we came to a few big conclusions. The first is a sort of wholesale abdication of U.S. leadership across the board. We knew we had a window of time now in these years when America was still on top before we had to deal with a growing China to try to set the rules of the world order. And it seems like Trump seems determined to squander that and instead to sort of prematurely withdraw. You could see that in the Paris climate talks and pulling out of UNESCO, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in the global migration talks. There's a big game out there to set these rules, and Trump has just really sidelined the country. And when you think about things like $13 trillion in clean energy investments that the countries in the Paris Accords are going to make in the next 10 years, the idea that we're yelling about coal instead of rushing to grab these opportunities with both hands is just, it's a tremendous surrender of leadership. You know, and then looking inside the country, we just saw the damaging of institutions, the politicizing of the military, the militarizing of the State Department, and the kind of trampling of the norms and institutions against enriching yourself in the job, which kind of goes hand in hand with this sort of moral abdication on the world stage, the praising of dictators, the surrendering of this great signal achievement of the United States, of this idea that there are universal human rights out there that countries need to respect and pay attention to. That didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen by accident. It happened because American presidents of both parties sustained it. Even where we fell short, we held to that principle. That seems to be giving way under Trump, and it's very concerning. And then, of course, they're the key big files, the most explosive and challenging issues we've got. North Korea, where Trump seems to be determined to make it worse one tweet at a time and isn't giving his secretaries of state and defense enough space to try to avoid this nuclear standoff where really nobody wins. Russia, which where Trump seems determined to pull punches and not adequately defend America's democracy from the kind of assault it faced in information warfare back in 2016. Even Jeff Sessions was asked if we're doing enough. He said, well, probably not. And that shrug of the shoulders and that refusal to criticize Putin is really something. And then in the Middle East, you see what I call the silent surge, which is basically the escalation of every single military conflict we've got, combined with basically a resolve to destroy the Iran deal without really having any sense of why or what should come in its place. So you take it all together, and it's quite a lot of shattered China and quite a lot of broken crockery. And as someone who served in the last administration and hopes to have a chance to serve again in another administration that I admire, there's going to be a lot of cleanup to do, and we'll be lucky to get back to right where we started.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Ben-Aim, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he researches U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One. And of course, hanging over this administration is the very legitimacy of the way Trump was elected and the extent to which the Putin and the Russians had a hand in it, and that's being investigated by the special counsel. If you take the extreme version is that Trump could be the Manchurian candidate, obviously that might explain his foreign policy, although that seems far-fetched. But if you take a more realistic assessment, if Putin simply wanted to weaken America and didn't think Trump would necessarily win, but he would weaken Hillary Clinton by running around the country for 4 years saying, lock her up, lock her up. The point is that whatever way it worked out for Putin, whether it was Hillary or Trump, and he helped, obviously got lucky with Trump, the point is that what's happening is America is being weakened. And that, I think, is unassailably Putin's motive.
Yeah, I think you're right. In some way, Putin is like the dog that caught the fire truck. I think he never in his wildest dreams expected that this sort of very low investment in information warfare and hacking, weaponized hacking, would have such a fateful impact. I think he probably knew that he had a pretty good mark in Trump. Mostly, I think, even though these guys seemed eager to take Russia's help, I don't think they considered themselves to be working on Russia's behalf. They just seemed eager to take help from wherever they could, as best we can tell so far. But I think you're right. What Putin wanted to do was basically sow dissension in the U.S. system and weaken the likely next president, Hillary Clinton. And they found themselves smack in the middle of this. Of this presidency in a way that they didn't expect, and with a level of exposure on these relatively small intelligence activities that I think has to have shocked even them. But the truth is that none of this would even be possible if the United States weren't so divided that people wouldn't disqualify Trump for taking this kind of help. He was running out there on the campaign hustings saying, "I love WikiLeaks," and, you know, "Putin's a killer, but we have killers," and all these kinds of things. And if our politics weren't so tribal and divided to begin with, people would have said, "Well, that's outrageous. That's outrageous. You're clearly not fit for this job." But instead, Trump seemed so good at sticking it to people like me and you that that it really appealed to the rest of the country. So we got a lot of work to do, and frankly, some pretty deep questions to ask about how to heal these divides so we can be strong enough to resist this kind of interference going forward.
Sure, and the ultimate divide is there is no consensus about what is real and what is true in this country, and you've got 30 to 35% of the country believing Trump's lies and thinking that the mainstream media is fake news, and this 35% living inside the Fox News bubble are immune to evidence and facts. And
it's a very scary thing. Yeah, I've seen that around the world in my travels in places like Egypt and Iraq. You see what happens with official lying.
Exactly.
People stop believing the government. They start believing the conspiracy theories. And this idea, it may be in some ways the single greatest casualty of this whole presidency, is this idea of a common truth, this idea that we can all look out and see one America and work to advance its interests together. That's, to be honest, of all of the pieces, that's going to be one of the ones that's the hardest to put back together again in the wake of this man and his presidency. Even if he's fully repudiated at some point by the people and by the courts, it's hard to imagine that that bubble really bursts. But those of us who are invested in the outcome are going to have to find a way to try to get to those people as well and create a more united united public. Because when I looked at all the ways in which Trump was weakening America, I think it was that sense of bitter, bitter division that basically politics is about pitting some Americans against others, which is the way that Trump practices politics, as opposed to trying to be everyone's president, that is probably the biggest outcome in terms of weakening the country and the world, even more than the things he's actually done in the world. Because if we're not strong and we're not united to face these challenges together, then other people are going to be able to divide and rule. And you know, pit us against each other as Russia did so effectively.
Well, let's say, if you don't mind, go to a clip of Senator Jeff Flake, the Republican senator who gave a very, very powerful speech today before the U.S. Senate. And he actually talked about the lasting damage to our foreign policy. Just quoting him, "Mr. President, so powerful is the presidency that the damage done by the sustained attack on the truth will not be confined to the president's time in office." Let's go to Senator Jeff Flake today, and then we'll resume the conversation.
It was a year in which an unrelenting daily assault on the constitutionally protected free speech was launched by the same White House, an assault that is as unprecedented as it is unwarranted. "The enemy of the people" was how the President of the United States called the free press in 2017. Mr. President, it is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase "enemy of the people" that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, "annihilating such individuals," unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader. This alone should be the source of great shame for us in this body, especially for those of us in the president's party, for they are shameful, repulsive statements. And of course, the president has it precisely backward. Despotism is the enemy of the people. The free press is the despot's enemy, which makes the free press the guardian of democracy. When a figure in power reflexively calls any press that doesn't suit him fake news, it is that person who should be the figure of suspicion, not the press.
And that was Republican Senator Jeff Flake speaking on the Senate floor today. The idea that you can liken our president to Joseph Stalin in itself is pretty depressing, wouldn't you say, Daniel?
You know, I sure would. I don't know that I would go so far myself to draw that analogy directly, given the things that Stalin did. Trump hasn't done those things. Trump has his own sins to answer for, but they're not the same as Stalin's. And they're not in this, they're orders of magnitude smaller. But the larger question, the idea that someone would be tempted to make that connection, is a reflection of Trump's lack of respect for the 240 years of democratic tradition we have in this country. The idea that he talks about my generals as though he were a kind of military junta chief, I certainly understand. But one of the enduring challenges for all of us in this time is to keep a sense of perspective, you know, because we see these resonances and this authoritarian valence in what he's doing, and we're trying to stop it. But it doesn't mean he is an authoritarian in his actual practices. It doesn't mean he is Stalin or he is a junta leader. It just scares us that he sounds like one. And right. Part of our job as citizens is to really distinguish those differences. So I admire Senator Flake's moral clarity on a lot of these issues. But I'd probably respectfully part ways on the Stalin analogy.
Well, the analogy, of course, being to the enemy of the people and making the press the enemy of the people.
Well, when he quotes Stalin, he certainly does make it easy for people to draw that analogy, let's be clear, yeah.
Well, but I think, in a way, Trump is an authoritarian without the fascist ideology or the Stalinist ideology. I think he's more like a Roman emperor, in fact, which Chris Buckley pointed out in an op-ed in the New York Times.
That was a hilarious piece of writing.
Yeah, but I think an accurate
piece.
I
highly recommend to your listeners.
Yeah. Well, just in closing, then, it is painful and sad to recognize how much work has to be done to undo the damage done so far. But is there any sense that you have that since this man is so unqualified, didn't even expect to get the job, clearly doesn't know what he's doing, is totally out of his depth, governs by distraction and stunt? And the next guest on our program today done a study at the Brookings Institution looking into social media and internet search data from Google, which indicates that the public are tiring of this guy. So is there a quicker way out than having to wait till 2020?
You know, I think my strong guess is that this person, Trump, will serve at least his full term. I suppose it would be theoretically possible that something would go so disastrously wrong, or the Democrats would have sufficient margins in both houses and decide to pursue this kind of strategy. But even if he gets impeached by the House of Representatives, the Senate would need to vote him out of office. I think that this is probably a problem best solved at the polls. My hope is that in come a year from now, he will have a very strong congressional check on his power in the form of a Democratic Senate and Congress, that will block off some pathways that he might use to try to enact damaging parts of his agenda, and that'll give us new tools for oversight. But I think the real key here is to use the institutions that we've got, the democracy that we've got, to try to forge a better path forward, and if things get worse, to look maybe to those other tools. But I think we shouldn't look to be rescued by some provision of the Constitution that's never been invoked. We have to live in the here and now in our democracy and fight on a daily basis for the policies that we believe in, and find ways to mitigate the worst and try to pursue, make good things happen at whatever level of government we can.
Well, Daniel Ben-Ayim, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Ben-Ayim, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, researching U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, as well as a visiting lecturer at New York University. And previously, he served as a Middle East policy advisor and foreign policy speechwriter at the White House, the Department of State, and the U.S. Senate. And he has a new report at the Center for American Progress, Trump's National Security and Foreign Policy Failures, Year One. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the author of a new report, What Internet Search Data Reveals About Donald Trump's First Year in Office. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now are Darrell West, the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he is the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He's the author of Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval and Social Strife in the 21st Century, and Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. And he has a new report at Brookings, What Internet Search Data Reveal About Donald Trump's First Year in Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, Darrell West.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you. And as we approach the first year anniversary in a few days, of course, today there was a very powerful speech on the Senate floor by Senator Jeff Flake making comparisons between Donald Trump and Stalin and implying that Donald Trump is a despot and these attacks on the press are the acts typical of despots. So, but let's talk about what you're revealing in this study, and that is you've basically gone after all of the Google searches, right? 88% of the searches in this country on the internet are done through Google. And what, there's something like 2 trillion searches per year around the world that Google currently hosts. What have you learned from going through these Google searches in terms of the public interest in Trump and his administration?
Well, one of the things we discovered in looking at the internet search data from the past year was that public interest in Trump has plummeted during the course of 2017. As one might expect, during the actual inauguration week, interest in Trump was incredible. Since then, over the course of 2017, public interest in Trump dropped to no more than 20% of that initial level. So his act is starting to wear thin. People, I think, are souring on him. They're tired of all the shenanigans, the tweets, the rude comments, the policy decisions that he's making. People are not nearly as interested in him as they were a year ago.
But what I find a little paradoxical about the data that you come up with, Darrell, is that the top states in terms of Trump interest include the District of Columbia, which is the hometown of politics, if you will, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Maryland, all blue states, Democratic-leaning states. So what does that tell us? Are Democrats masochists? I mean, this guy's driving Democrats crazy. And what does it say about red states being less interested? Are they in the Fox bubble? Do they think everything is great? They don't need to follow the news except for Fox?
Well, interest is not approval. The fact that a lot of people in blue states are searching for information on Trump does not mean that they like him. If anything, it actually probably means the opposite of that, that their discontent with Trump and the policies that he is pursuing is leading them to try and find information about him. And so I think it's no accident that it's the blue states where the interest is highest. That's also the place where the discontent is greatest.
But what does it say about the red states?
Well, what it says is that they're not as energized by Trump. They're not as upset by him. They're not as dissatisfied. And so, therefore, they don't have the same need to search for information about him. I think there is some link between discontent and high levels of interest.
So I guess the takeaway here is that, I mean, let's face it, this is a reality TV star who's got the ultimate role, survivor in the White House, if you will. So is this really a case of his act getting stale? He's very unusual, and he seems more like a television creature than he certainly has no government experience and doesn't appear to have much interest in governance. He spends an inordinate amount of the day watching television, and that seems to be his sort of reality and his anchor, if you will. So if we could talk about this in terms of television ratings, which is what Donald Trump often refers to, is this a case of basically his act getting stale?
I think his act is getting stale. Like, you know, initially everybody was following the tweets and there was shock and outrage. But I think given the fact that he has continued the same patterns of behavior over the last 12 months and has not really changed much during that time, people just no longer are as excited by it. They're not as interested in it. They're actually starting to tune him out. And so his ability to drive the agenda is going to be much more limited. I think people just think that what he's doing is beyond the pale, and it does not bode well for his future popularity.
And in terms of him being a television president, is there a correlation here, the amount of time that he watches? One of the observations that I've made is that if you were an actor, this would be like not being interested in your performance, only interested in the reviews. And that seems to be what we have in this president, somebody that doesn't really have much interest in the actual work of governance, but an inordinate amount of interest in how the press covers him. So is there a connection here between the social media and the extent to which this is a president obsessed with his own coverage? Because after all, it's worth noting that this man got elected largely because his team, particularly Cambridge Analytica and the Mercers and Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, they used social media, whereas Hillary Clinton was using the old-fashioned television advertising platforms, and she spent about $1.4 billion. He spent about $861 million. But there's no question that Trump got more bang for the buck by targeting through social media. So what's your take on the sophistication, if you will, with social media? And is it translating for them? It doesn't seem to, this, what you've discovered doesn't seem to be indicating that it's helping them at all, their sophistication with social media.
Well, he is obsessed with his news coverage, and he obviously is obsessed with social media, but people are losing interest in him. It's like, you know, he does a lot of things to keep himself in the news, and I'm sure if you kind of looked at the number of news stories about him, that remains equally high. But when you look at the internet search data, it suggests the public interest has dropped sharply over the course of 2017. So despite the fact that he's still driving a lot of news coverage, he's starting to lose the general public, the very thing that he also cares about. And, you know, unless he makes some changes, I think it's going to be very difficult for him to sustain interest over time.
So does that mean then, Darryl, that, you know, people that cover him on a daily basis like myself, I often refer to as the daily dose of doom, are we being manipulated and whipsawed here? Because it does feel like this is government by stunt. And many people think that a lot of the chaos generated by this president might well be deliberate to distract us from the fact that he doesn't have a clue how to run the country and he's completely out of his depth.
I think reporters are being manipulated. You know, what he puts out is kind of like catnip, and the cat always responds to that. But reporters should understand that the public takes a longer-term view on things like this. They are seeing through what he's doing, and they're actually starting to get bored with him. And so what that means is his ability to drive the agenda is going to be much more limited, I think, in 2018 compared to what we saw early in 2017, just because the public is not paying attention in the same way that they were 12 months ago. And so he needs to take that seriously, because these searches are based on billions and billions of searches by people all across the country. So these are data, aggregate data in real time, based on what people are doing. And what people are telling us through their search behavior is they're not interested in this guy anymore.
But conversely, I understand from your search data that you've analyzed that as less interest is paid to Trump, more interest is being paid to the issue of impeachment. There was a peak in May when FBI Director James Comey was fired, and apparently a peak also, or a spike, I should say, is a better way to put it, right after we find that many of the president's top his campaign advisors and his national security advisors have either pled guilty or faced federal indictment.
Yeah, we looked at public interest in impeachment throughout 2017, and for most of the year, it's pretty low. But as you point out, there were two periods where there were sharp increases. The first was in May, right around the time when Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. There's a lot of attention to that. There was a big backlash against that. That was really the first moment when impeachment really spiked up from a public standpoint, that they were searching for information about impeachment. They wanted to know how the process operated. So, you know, that suggests people do respond to events. And then the second peak took place in November when Paul Manafort was indicted along with some other of Trump's leading advisors. There's a lot of attention to that. And those federal indictments, again, drove a lot of public interest in impeachment. And so what it suggests to me is in 2018, people need to pay close attention to the Mueller report, which will be coming out at some point once he has finished the investigation. And depending on what he finds, you know, that could be another way that that engages the public, increases interest in impeachment, and creates greater political trouble for President Trump.
But it seems that the other interest that the public has had in terms of Google searches related to President Trump's first year in office have been over the issue of health care.
Healthcare was certainly a big factor in engaging the public. Certainly, during the period of summer of 2017, when Congress made its first attempt to repeal Obamacare, but failed in that effort, there was tremendous interest in healthcare at that point. In particular, there was interest in access to healthcare. People seemed to be very worried that if the repeal effort succeeded, they were going to lose health care, and they were searching for information about how to deal with that. So we found that to be interesting just in terms of how the public responded to some of the efforts that were taking place in Congress.
Well, I think the reason, certainly why I find your study, Darrell West, being more valuable is because most of what we get in terms of approval ratings and, you know, the sort of up and down of daily polls and et cetera, they operate on these traditional methods, usually through phone calls. And of course, it may not be that accurate since the millennials don't have phones, they have cell phones. And so there's a lot of questions about the kind of data we get on a daily basis. But the value of mining the data from Google and from Google searches is, it's tangible, isn't it? Because it's all electronically measured. It's much more reliable, surely, as data than what pollsters get by phoning up people.
It's reliable because it basically deals with billions and billions of searches that take place in the United States in any year. It's also behavioral information in the sense that it's not a pollster calling up someone, people maybe not understanding the question or just giving some flip answer off the top of their head. Like, the search data are based on actual behavior. Like, people are searching for information on Trump. They're searching for information on impeachment. And so we were able to look at the data, and I think those types of social media data points provide an interesting counterpoint to polling data, studies of news coverage, studies of what is going on in Congress, because it reflects people's actual behavior.
But there's another side, surely, Darrell West, to the people's fatigue with Trump, that they're getting tired of his antics, which is the main takeaway from your research. Is it possible that Trump fatigue, outrage fatigue, will actually help him, in the sense that I started out by mentioning the very powerful speech that Senator Flake made today on the floor of the Senate, where he really went after Trump in very, very passionate ways about that he's more or less the, not the press is the enemy of the people, but Trump is. He's the enemy of democracy. He's destroying our democracy. I mean, some of the stuff likening him to Stalin and other despots, it was pretty stunning. But it's already being dismissed by the White House. Oh, he's just a bitter failure who's on his way out of the Senate, and his polls are down, and they love Trump in Arizona, and they don't like Flake, so why would anybody listen to him? I mean, they're very good. I mean, like this woman, Sarah Sanders, is awfully good at what she does, defending the indefensible. But in the broader sense, it may not necessarily be healthy that we're sort of becoming inured to his behavior. And instead of being outraged by more and more behavior, like the S-hole remark, etc., it's just going to sort of numb us. And to that extent, maybe he's getting away with it.
Well, it certainly is a risk if the public gets numb to the point of not paying attention. But I think if you look at all of the search data, it does suggest that when he does things particularly egregious, like firing the former FBI director, people do respond and they get upset about that and they start looking for information on impeachment. So I don't think people are giving up. I think the thing that's interesting is it's not unusual in the last year of a president's term for there to be fatigue. Like we remember fatigue with George W. Bush in 2008. There was some fatigue with Obama in 2016. The Trump fatigue is taking place in the first year of his presidency, you know, not the fourth year. So people are getting fatigued with him much earlier than typically is the case with the past presidents. And I think that's something he has to take seriously. That's a warning sign about his political future.
Well, Darrell West, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Darrell West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, where he's the founding director of the Center for Technology Innovation. He's the author of Mega Change, Economic Disruption, Political Upheaval and Social Strife in the 21st Century, and Billionaires, Reflections on the Upper Crust. And he has a new report at Brookings, What Internet Search Data Reveal About Donald Trump's First Year in Office. And we'll also have a link to Darrell West's study at backgroundbriefing.org. Let's now take a brief station break and be back examining the arrest of an ex-CIA officer charged with spying for China, who is suspected of exposing the CIA spy network in China, causing the murder or capture of around 20 undercover U.S. agents.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You brought a lot of money.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is June Dreyer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Dreyer.
Thank you.
And June, what do you make of this roll-up of, it looks like the CIA's entire network in China was compromised. The Chinese, they didn't just arrest these people, they killed a lot of them, if not most of them. And it looks as though this is a devastating setback for the CIA, losing more than a dozen informants. And basically, I don't know how many years went into recruiting these people, but Obviously, they've been looking for a mole for some time, the FBI counterintelligence people, and now they've arrested somebody who obviously made the mistake of returning from Hong Kong to the United States. So to begin with, we've spoken over the years about other intelligence compromises of U.S. assets and U.S. technology mostly through economic espionage here in the United States where the Chinese appear to be active. Give us your impression, if you will, of how good the Chinese are and how ubiquitous and pervasive they appear to be.
They are very ubiquitous and pervasive, and they're getting better because they are using IT technology and not only on us, but on their own people very effectively. So you really can't get away with much. And this is, of course, it's a human tragedy for the assets who were killed. And it's also a severe embarrassment for the CIA. And it follows a number of severe embarrassments. And what I wondered when reading the story was why, if the CIA had discovered these tiny notebooks full of documents when the FBI was searching his baggage in 2012, why something wasn't done sooner? Because meanwhile, people were arrested and people died because of what he was doing.
Well, specifically, this Jerry Chun Xing Li, 53-year-old naturalized U.S. citizen from China. He was served in the U.S. Army, joined the CIA, and apparently his career had sort of languished somewhat. He left the agency disgruntled, having joined it in 1994. I think he left in about around 2010, I think. But in any case, he left 2007.
Seven,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Then he moved to Hong Kong. So he came back to the United States in 2012, as you just mentioned, to visit his family in Virginia. The FBI searched his luggage and his hotel stays in Hawaii and Virginia. They found these two small books with handwritten notes that contained classified information where Li had written down details about meetings between CIA informants and undercover agents with their names and phone numbers. So you're right. What more evidence do you need that this guy is spying? I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Well, I am assuming that not everyone who comes back from Hong Kong gets the FBI in his hotel room photocopying notebooks. And so the FBI must have had strong suspicions in order to get the necessary legal permission to do that. And so why nothing happens for, my gosh, this is 2018, and let's charitably say this was 2017, but that's 5 years.
Right.
And meanwhile, people are dying because of what he did.
So was there this rivalry, institutional rivalry between the FBI and the CIA involved in this? My understanding is CIA, the FBI counterintelligence people who were on the case weren't happy with the cooperation they were getting from the CIA. Is that your understanding?
Well, that's going to be the whine that you hear every time something goes wrong. And it will never get solved, and it will keep going on. But how legitimate a whine is it, and how much is it to just pass the buck to some other agency? And I know there's a kind of friendly rivalry between the two of them, and the FBI people refer to the CIA people as clowns in action, and the CIA people refer to the FBI people as fibbies. But, I mean, after all, the end goal is the same, to protect the country, and this isn't being done very well. And furthermore, I have another recent example for you, and that is the example involving Mr. Guo Wenhui, otherwise known as Miles Kwok, who was actually threatened in a tape recorded conversation by Chinese officials who were in the United States on visas that did not allow them to conduct official business. and mean well. They call him up and say, quit your activism and return home. Otherwise, the government, if you do, the government will release your assets that they've frozen and they'll leave your relatives alone, implying not only that his assets were frozen, but that his relatives were not being left alone. And now the FBI wanted to move against these officials because they had very obviously did something illegal. And according to the New York Times account of this, no, I'm sorry, it was the Wall Street Journal, the State Department tended to, and I'm quoting here, tended to favor a less confrontational approach and allowed them to go back to China. So, in other words, this isn't just FBI CIA, this is FBI State Department. And why is the State Department doing this?
And these clearly were Chinese intelligence officials.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, I'm speaking with June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization, and Tradition. Now, the State Department has also been penetrated, apparently, by the Chinese, because in March, the
Mallory.
Yes, exactly. Candace Marie Claiborne was arrested. She was a longtime State Department employee, and she apparently had been less than honest with intelligence officials interviewing her about her Chinese contacts.
Well, so, the indictment said that Chinese agents had wired cash into her bank account and given her thousands of dollars in gifts.
Hmm. Well, maybe they were just being nice to her. I mean, what are we supposed to believe here? I mean, you know, one of the most amazing things, June, is that, as you know, Rupert Murdoch is quite a powerful figure on the global stage and very influential with Fox News, et cetera, here in this country. He's running around telling everybody that will listen to him that his ex-wife, Wendy Deng, is a Chinese agent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is going on here, do you think? Obviously, this is a totalitarian state that has enormous resources, and as its economy grows, so does its military budget and presumably its intelligence budget. Is that your understanding?
Yes. and they seem to be getting better and better at it. And we are not doing anything much to counter it. And if the State Department is allowing someone to leave who has some group of people, in fact, to leave who have very clearly broken the terms of their admittance here, and the State Department is getting in the way of the FBI, what does that tell you? What is going on here?
Well, I'm assuming that the Chinese have intelligence officials over here watching all of these students that come to the United States, many of whom are the children of the elite, and to get an education, and particularly out here in California, USC and other universities have a very, very high ratio of Chinese students. Is that going on, to your understanding, that they're watching the students?
Oh, very definitely, and I think they have some students watching other students.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a student will be perhaps from a struggling middle-class family who would really like to study abroad is told, well, we will pay your tuition, but you have to watch your fellow students and tell us if you see something that isn't quite the party line, so to speak.
Well, is there a connection, though, to this intelligence loss of the CIA's network of spies and agents being rolled up in China? Is it connected in any way to the OPM breach, the Office of Personnel Management, we're told was penetrated by Chinese hackers, and they took the entire files of all federal employees, including military and intelligence officers, and apparently it gives everything, you know, the address, the name, the education, the resumes, everything you'd want to know about people, and it wouldn't take much to go cross-referencing all of that data and finding out who the CIA people are in China under diplomatic cover. Are you aware of a connection there at all?
The Obama administration, of course, was severely embarrassed by this. The woman who was in charge of the department was very clearly a political appointee from back in Chicago and has charitably been described as a hack, you know, a political hack. Mm-hmm. And so they are at pains to shove this as far under the carpet as they can. But this is the kind of thing that happens, and we are not trying to protect ourselves against us, and the consequences can be very severe. But I do think that the information that this person who's just arrested is alleged to have been, it doesn't come from the Office of Personnel Management.
No, but there is something else, though, that's systemic and very problematic. Is if you look at all of the major breaches of the NSA with Edwin Snowden, he was working for a contractor, and the more recent fellow that they arrested who had an awful lot of material at home, and there's a suspicion, and nobody's ever made the link, of how it is that the so-called shadow brokers, which is a Russian front, were able to get all of these NSA hacking tools from this guy. It may have something to do with Kaspersky software. That seems to be the most likely connection of how all this stuff ended up, these hacking tools ended up on the web and ended up in North Korea and in Russia. So there's two cases of contractors breaching, and then you've got the OPM breach.
There's actually a third contractor for NSA, and he worked for the same contracting agency, I think it was SAI, mm-hmm. as Snowden did. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
well, that
now
was
Booz
Allen Hamilton, I think, Snowden.
It was Booz Allen Hamilton.
Right.
Sorry.
So I was going to say the OPM hack happened because the contractor was no damn good. I mean, it wasn't the Office of Personnel Management itself, their systems that were hacked, but a contractor's systems. So you don't have to be Einstein to see a kind of thread here, surely, that we have a problem with the security intelligence contractors, how they're handling classified data.
Well, I read quite a bit about this because obviously it's a very interesting topic. And the contracting agencies tend to blame the fact that there aren't enough investigator personnel to do a careful vetting job, and they need somebody right away, so they accept a less than rigorous screening. And other people say, well, what the problem is outsourcing. It was very fashionable a couple of years ago. Outsourcing saves money, and this is one of the consequences of it. So there are plenty of places to assign blame and choose whatever one is convenient for you. But, I mean, I think your basic point remains that we are doing a lot of things wrong, and we need to rethink what we're doing. But it isn't just one thing.
Well, but does anybody do a kind of cost-benefit analysis here, or at least an after-action report on the damage done? Because presumably billions of dollars have had to be spent to replace systems that have been compromised, mm-hmm. particularly with the NSA, I would think. In any case, can you add this to, I wanted to broaden it out a little bit in terms of the U.S. relations with China, not just in terms of intelligence competition, but in the broader sense of China being a rising power, and many argue that the United States is in a period of eclipse. The first thing that Donald Trump did, of course, was get rid of the TPP, which was an arrangement that had, I think, as much to do with geopolitics as it had to do with trade. And now, of course, a lot of analysts are saying that Donald Trump's latest insult to the entire continent of Africa is another gift to China. As a China mm-hmm. scholar, how do you see, has Trump been a gift to China?
No, not really. And I also question the facile statement, which I hear over and over and over, China as a rising power.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese economy is in a period of decline. Several important areas, including Baotou and Tianjin recently, have been discovered to have inflated their production statistics to look better. In other words, they weren't producing what they said they were.
Sure.
And there's also a lot of evidence that the Chinese economy is being artificially propped up by the government because the true figures are much lower and much worse. And they fear economic instability because the income is very, very badly distributed. Some people have gotten very wealthy and other people stay poor. And there's a lot of resentment. So in what sense is China saying, oh, we can say this is a rising power? We can't. But
right.
People do it anyway. And mm-hmm. people who should know better.
Well, but what you're telling us is, in fact, is very reminiscent of why the Soviet Union collapsed. We, you know, the old joke was that we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And
mm-hmm.
and you had these five-year plans and all of these ludicrous statistics. And it got so bad that the KGB were the only ones who kept the books and realized that the country was going to the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they brought in Perestroika and Glasnost. So it sounds like China's got the same problem because it has the same political system, the Chinese Communist Party. So mm-hmm. do the party people all lie to each other and pretend everything is hunky-dory?
Meanwhile, getting out their money in any way they can.
Right, and sending
there
out
has been
their kids
an
abroad,
amazing,
right?
Yeah. An amazing capital flight out of China. And that's also the reason the government has cracked down, or at least tried to crack down recently, on Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was one of the ways people were using to get their money out. There's also been a crackdown on gambling because these casinos in Macau were a very convenient way to get your money out of the country. And even more conveniently, many of them are branches of casinos in Las Vegas.
And Sheldon Adelson has gotten very rich, right?
Because I guess you would say he's gotten even richer.
Even richer, right, right. Well, just in the last minute, though, could you address the critique that happens a lot now that Donald Trump has been a gift to China by canceling the TPP and the most recent insults about Africa? China, we know, is very active in Africa. The assumption is that U.S. diplomacy has been hurt by the president's remarks, and China will be the beneficiary.
It doesn't look good. He should not have said that. I think that any black eye United States gets about this will be temporary.
Well, June Dreyer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay. Good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asia-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.